History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we've learned they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then invest some time listening patiently enough for long-buried memories to take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This coming December, we're going to mark the 82nd anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And as we know, with each passing year, there are fewer and fewer people still with us who were there on Oahu on that day of infamy. We've had the privilege of meeting quite a few Pearl Harbor survivors here on Hometown Heroes over the years, and unfortunately, I just received word this week that one of them had passed away at the age of 103. Francisco Paredes, Frank to anyone who had the privilege of hanging out with him in recent years in Atwater, California. He shared his story here nearly a decade ago. On our most recent Pearl Harbor Day in 2022, he took the stage at a remembrance ceremony in Clovis, California, and he moved the crowd with his memories of that fateful day in Hawaii. But his story before and after Pearl Harbor is one with enough twists and turns to fill a few feature films. From landing craft to bombers to the front lines with the infantry, his five kids heard countless stories of his close calls, including the three times he was wounded in World War II. But he almost died in an Arizona copper mine before World War II ever began. It's always better in the voice of a veteran himself than to have me or anybody else try to tell the story, and this episode today again underscores that sentiment I shared moments ago when I mentioned preserving veteran stories. Frank Paredes has moved on to post everlasting after 103 years on this planet, but because he was willing to share his story, we have perspective we wouldn't have otherwise. We're going to listen to Frank's life story over the next hour. He was one of four brothers to serve in World War II, but that quartet represented only half of the boys in the family and only a quarter of the siblings. He grew up in the Dragoon Mountains of southeastern Arizona, which got their name from the 3rd U.S. Cavalry Dragoons that fought Cochise and Company in the Apache Wars there in the 1850s. Frank Paredes was always proud of his family's Apache heritage.
I had 8 brothers and 8 sisters. Most of them are gone. I only have 2 sisters left, no brothers.
What's it like to grow up in that big of a family? Because I think most of us don't know what it's like to be one of 16 kids, 4 or 5 maybe, but 16's a lot.
Well, it's kind of hard, you know, because at 16, I worked in the mines in Arizona, and that wasn't for me.
That copper mines or silver mines or what?
Copper mines. So anyway, I got hurt. I was 2,000 feet down a shaft, and I got hurt. And then the company found out that I was underage, so that I wouldn't sue them. They paid me off with $9,000, and that was a lot of money at the time.
Especially for a 16-year-old.
Right. So I got my mom and 2 of my sisters, and 1, I guess, would be a niece, and we went to Mexico. This is my some other family down there, you know. We stayed down there for about maybe 2 weeks. Then I came back, and then I told Mom, I says, let's go to California. She said, what are you going to do in California? I says, sell everything you have, and I'll find you a place in California for you. So I did, you know, and we moved back to California, to Monterey, California. We stayed there for about maybe a year. And then she wanted to go back to Arizona, so I took her back. And then the second time when I brought her, I said, Mom, I says, I came after you. I want to take you to California. I want to set you up. Here's the bad news. I'm going to join the military. That's what I want to do. I was about 20 years old. So she said, okay, we'll go to California. So I got her set up. So I joined a tuna fishing fleet, Albacore tuna, in South America, in Peru. So I did that, and I came back with a pretty good chunk of money. So when I told her, I said, okay, Mama, this is the deal. I'm setting you up. Now here's the bad news. I'm going to join the military. So that's when I did. That was in September the 16th of 1941. I had to find something for me to do, something to be helpful. So that's what I did. I joined the military. They sent me to Hawaii. I was on my way to Manila to join the troops in Manila. So I was waiting in Pearl Harbor, Schofield Barracks actually, on a cadre to go, waiting for more people to show up to go to Manila. But that's when I got caught, you know. Incidentally, a friend of mine, his name was Max Druin. He went in the Navy, and I went in the Army. He was aboard the USS West Virginia. I was in Schofield Barracks. So on Saturday night, December the 6th, I went to Pearl Harbor to visit with him. And we had a few beers, you know, and chatted, you know, about the hometown and this and that. I told Max, I says, I got to catch the last shuttle to Schofield Barracks. Otherwise, I'll be stranded here, you know. And I do help the priest say Mass on Sunday mornings. So I caught my shuttle, went back, and I made it okay. 8 o'clock, about 5 minutes to eight, I was on my way to church for Mass. And all of a sudden, I heard a big noise, and the sirens went off. And they says, this is not a drill. This is not a drill. All personnel report to your stations. I didn't have a station, but we did have machine guns set up, you know. So what I did, I manned the first machine gun that I could find, and it was a Twin 50 on a Heinz mount. I spotted this torpedo bomber. He was probably about maybe 150, 200 feet up in the air. I could see the pilot, and I took a burst at him, and I missed him. Then I gave him a lead, and then I took another burst at him, and I smoked him. I don't know whether he went down, but I'm pretty sure he did went down because he started going towards the ocean. So that's where everything went haywire. So I started picking up, fighting fires, helping out, you know, with whatever I did. And I helped for about maybe 7 or 8 days. And then I got on, they put me on a ship, and I was on my way to Australia.
Well, let me come back to that, because I want to, before we get too far past it, I want to ask you about that time on Oahu, because you described it, and I know you lived it, and you probably tell these stories a few times, but you're a 21-year-old kid, you're on your way to Mass, and all of a sudden, World War II begins for America, and you're right there in the thick of it, and you hop on a machine gun and shoot a Japanese plane. What did this feel like? Because I imagine that's a pretty big shock to your system, that all of a sudden you're at war and the world is crazy. How did you deal with that?
I know it was crazy. So I joined the military for one thing and one thing only, to do what I had to do for my country. And that's what I did.
Was it scary for you in that moment? I mean, this is day one. I mean, you knew maybe something was going to happen at some point, but now it's actually here right in your face.
Yeah, it was scary. But the way I figured, you live at one day at a time. And that's the way it went, you know, all through my military life.
And you said you were helping out for 7 or 8 days in the aftermath of the Japanese attack. And there aren't a whole lot of people left with us anymore that actually saw those things with their own two eyes. What are some of the things that you saw and experienced in those days following the attack that you still remember today, that in when you close your eyes, you can still picture exactly what that looked like?
Well, to me, you know, I still have dreams about that. And those dreams, you know, make you, to me, they make you go on and on, live your life as you want to live it.
Were you around Schofield Barracks cleaning up, or did you go down to the harbor and help with pulling bodies out of the water and all that?
Yes, I went to, I started pulling bodies, limbs, you know, arms, legs, you know, and heads, and it was awful. Thinking about it, you know, it makes me cry. The poor people, innocent people, that got caught in a turmoil like that.
And I know there are other moments, because this is just the start of the war and you were in for a while, but when you think back specifically about December 7th, is there part of you that says, yeah, I could have been one of those more than 2,000 that died there?
Yes, I lost a few friends. I lost, especially in Schofield Barracks, I lost a few friends there. And then aboard the USS Arizona, I lost a cousin. His name was William Webb. So when I went back to Pearl Harbor in 1990, I went to the memorial, and there was Japanese people going to the USS Arizona, and they were speaking in Japanese, and they were descendants of the pilots that had bombed Pearl Harbor, because, you know, I had a lot of Japanese friends here before the war. And I learned a little bit about Japanese, you know. I could understand some of it, but not all of it. But they had, you know, people there too, you know, wanted to go see the memorial. And then the memorial, you could still see oil coming up. And I think that'll go on forever, because there's a lot of people that are buried there, you know, underwater.
Is your cousin one of them?
Yes.
And at the time, back in 1941, I'm sure there was some uncertainty at first. You guys didn't know who had survived, who hadn't. When did you find out that your cousin had died, and what did that do to you?
I found out that when after the war, I went to my cousin's, you know, to his mom, you know. Her name was Clotilde. She says, I'm very proud of my son. He died a hero. Anyway, that's about all I can remember about him, you know. But getting back to picking up bodies, parts of bodies, taking them, you know, to a grave registration, it took a while, you know, to get everything, you know, squared away.
And I know you'd been exposed to a lot through working in the mines and doing your tuna trip to South America and all that. So you'd seen a lot and experienced a lot, but I can't imagine that being easy to see this death and destruction all around you. How did you cope with that? How did you deal with it at the time?
Well, you have to deal with whatever comes along. You have to deal with it, you know, one way or the other. Some people, as a rule, you know, deals like what I went through, they'd go bananas. But I kept my wits, you know, and I'm doing fine as of now, you know. And I'm still doing great.
What's the secret? How do you do that?
You would have to ask me that. I think it's my Indian heritage. As I was growing up, I did a lot of things what the Indians did. And to this day, I still do when I can, you know. Believe it or not, I do powwows at Table Mountain Casino here in California. Once in a while, I go to Window Rock, Arizona. Because I had some original Code Talkers in Window Rock, and they're all buried in Fort Defiance, Arizona. And I go there once in a while. You can't drink Corona there anymore.
When I talk to guys who are at Pearl Harbor, and I talk to guys who just served in the war, period, remember Pearl Harbor. I mean, it was three words that seemed to hold a lot of weight for them. For you, as you go on, and we're going to hear some of your adventures in the rest of the war, how big of a motivation was what you had seen and experienced at Pearl Harbor? What did Remember Pearl Harbor mean to you?
It meant to me that Remember Pearl Harbor, keep on going and give them hell. And that's what we did.
And we're going to hear some of the ways Frank was involved in doing that, on land, at sea, and even in the air when we come back. Pearl Harbor survivor Frank Paredes has passed away at the age of 103, and we're honoring his legacy today. If you'd like to join us at his memorial service, that's going to take place Friday, October 27th in Merced, California. And I have those details posted for you online at hometownheroesradio.com. We'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.